From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. There are reports of continued fighting between Russia and Georgia despite a negotiated ceasefire. On today's Fresh Air, journalist James Traub joins us for insight on the roots of the crisis and its international meaning. He'll explain the relationship between Georgia and Russia, marked at times by affection and at others by hatred and suspicion. And Traub says Russia's new expansionism is driven in part by a determination to reassert its power to the West after years of economic chaos and international impotence. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Real Animal, the new album from Alejandro Escovedo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. There were reports of continued fighting in Georgia today, despite a ceasefire negotiated Monday between Russia and Georgia. The Caucasian nation Russian troops entered 5 days ago. Under the terms of the agreement, Russia was to confine its troops to the two breakaway regions that had sought independence from Georgia, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. The incursion into Georgia caused alarm among Western leaders fearful of an expansionist Russia. Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili has compared the Russian action to the Nazi incursion into Czechoslovakia before World War II. For some insight into the roots of the Georgian crisis and its international implications, we turn to journalist James Traub. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He's traveled to Georgia and has written widely on international affairs. His forthcoming book is called The Freedom Agenda. Traub's piece on the Georgian conflict in Sunday's New York Times Week in Review section is called Taunting the Bear. Well, James Traub, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's talk about some of the international context for this dispute. And a lot of people are saying that this represents Russia returning to an expansionist power like Tsarist Russia. Apart from this crisis, what is the evidence that you're seeing Russia become more aggressive internationally?
Well, you know, unlike in the Tsarist period when military force was the sole, really, almost the sole means of expansion, nowadays there are other tools that countries have. And so I think what people who make that argument, and I would certainly be one of them, would say or would look at is the use of Russia's oil and gas wealth, and especially in terms of natural gas, because oil, no matter how much oil you have, the people who are buying it from you can always turn someplace else. But that's not true with natural gas, which comes at a pipeline and can only be delivered by pipeline. So what Russia has done with recalcitrant neighbors like Ukraine is either cut off the supply of natural gas or it go from having a subsidized price to a market price, which often means quite a precipitate increase. What it's done with friendly neighbors like Armenia is keep that price very low. And this can get to quite a brutal point. I mean, in the case of Georgia, Russia simply cut off the supply in 2005 to let these people freeze in the dark. So there's been a lot of that. What's new in the situation with Georgia is the reversion to that much more old-fashioned, almost archaic in our world, form of territorial aggression. I mean, you know, big industrialized countries don't invade their neighbors.
What might be motivating Russia in this current period to be more aggressive?
Well, I think there's so many different things. One is clearly the humiliations of the 1990s produced an intensely nationalistic psychology which Putin himself played on. That is the sense that Russia was reduced from its great historic role of being a regional and even a global power to being quite a kind of almost third world country. And now suddenly the coincidence of Putin replacing Yeltsin and then of the price of oil and natural gas rising meant that a combination of a young, dynamic, nationalistic figure came along with a new surge in wealth. And so certainly there is that general sense. Now, there's also clearly a defensive sense. The Russians feel encircled, and it's very hard to understand because nothing looks very encircling from the point of view of those of us on the outside. But Russia feels that the Bush administration has, from their point of view, is the aggressor in this battle. And if you ask them, they would say, well, look at the way they're trying to push NATO up to our frontiers. In the 1990s, President Clinton promised President Yeltsin that NATO would not expand beyond the Eastern European countries that it took in, and now it has. It took the Baltic countries in, and now it's seeking to take in the Caucasus countries, which are very far from Russia.
So just to be clear on that point, we're talking about a Western military alliance that now includes former Warsaw Pact nations like Poland and Czechoslovakia and those small nations on the Baltic, right?
For Russia, which has a historic sphere of influence sense about both the Baltic nations and the Caucasus nations, they are, as far as they're concerned, the West is now trying to burrow into their neighborhood. And as many times you say, but NATO is no longer an anti-Russian alliance. We're doing things like fighting in Afghanistan, which is just as good for you as it is for us. That's not how the Russians see it. They see it in much more classic, old-fashioned terms.
You know, a naive question about NATO. You know, when the communist state fell and we no longer had this titanic contention of competing ideologies and economic systems, why not either dissolve NATO or expand it to even include a new democratic Russia. Was that ever considered?
Well, certainly the idea was that Russia, a new democratic Russia, would be incorporated into the security architecture of the West. I don't know that anybody ever contemplated including Russia in NATO, but certainly we now see that the G7, a group of industrialized countries, is often incorporated as the G8, which includes Russia. So there was the hope in the 1990s that Russia over time would become part of the bloc of democratic free market countries. The reforms of the 90s in Russia never took. And in many ways, they made the country much worse off than it had been before, and I probably humiliated people into the bargain. And so we see a reaction domestically inside Russia where an authoritarian government has actually proved to be extremely popular. And the kind of nationalist rhetoric and nationalist tactics that Putin uses have also been extremely popular. This thing is playing very, very well in Russia, or so one hears. And it would be surprising if that were not so. And it's going to be very difficult for the West to argue to Russia that you've done a terrible, unspeakable thing. You violated sovereignty. This is unacceptable. I mean, that in effect is the position the West is going to have to take, but it certainly won't be persuasive with the Russian people or with the Russian government.
You know, another view of Russian behavior is that what it has been seeking in recent years, and Henry Kissinger, I believe, has said this, that what Russia has really sought is a reliable international strategic partner, and it would have been perfectly happy for that to be the United States. What's your view of that notion?
Well, Henry Kissinger, so far as I know, is the only person who holds that view. He did express that, and it seems an oddly throwback kind of view. That is to say, it's a détente view, and it's very odd for me to be situating myself on the right of Henry Kissinger. In odd ways, for somebody of my generation who grew up in the 1960s and 70s, to be talking about Russia the way I am is very, very strange and unsettling, because I grew up at a time when people were criticizing the Cold War mentality and saying, oh, come on, Russia's really not that bad. It's just a rational state rationally seeking its self-interest. But, you know, when I talk to Russia scholars in the United States and elsewhere, they all say things like, you know, I know I'm not supposed to use psychological interpretations, but rather, you know, geostrategic ones, but you can't talk about Russia without resorting to a sense of national psychology, this deep sense of humiliation they suffered before, and this tremendous surge of nationalism that they feel now. And also, very much, Russia is very much Putin's Russia. And Putin is not, as in the Soviet times, a kind of status quo seeking apparatchik or bureaucrat. He has a really a bellicose sense and a very zero-sum sense of policy. You have to lose for him to win. And when you listen to the way Putin talks, there is a harshness and aggression to it. There is a blunt, in-your-face, almost bullying quality that you would never hear from any head of state. And I include the very bellicose and tough-spoken George Bush in that, in the world we live in today. It's quite overt that this is a country which is bent on restoring its sense of damaged pride.
Is there an example of that blunt, in-your-face style that comes to mind?
Yeah. I mean, the one that I kept hearing about when I was in Georgia was back in April. There was the fear then was that there would be a war not in South Ossetia but in Abkhazia, the other of the two breakaway provinces. And at the time, the UN, the EU, NATO, and the major capitals all basically backed Saakashvili in what seemed to be a growing tension with Russia. And so when things got to a fever pitch, Saakashvili initiated a call to Putin. And Saakashvili said to him, but everybody is on our side. The West is on our side. And Putin said, I don't think I can say this, unfortunately, on your radio station, so I'll have to use a polite locution. He said, you can take those statements and you know where you can put them, I suppose, is what I have to say.
But said in the most crude and direct way.
I think gutter language is right. The appropriate way of referring to it. And Saakashvili, who's, you know, himself kind of a tough guy and a little bit reckless too, was shocked. And he suddenly thought, oh my God, this guy will stop at nothing. He's personally enraged into the bargain.
Before we consider the particular situation in Georgia, people often talk about countries like Russia having legitimate security interests in regions nearby where there are conflicts. Is it fair to say that Russia has a legitimate security interest in Georgia?
Well, you know, this is an interesting and complicated question because by traditional modes of thinking about diplomacy, yes. I mean, after all, what was the Monroe Doctrine that the United States lived by for generations but the notion that we had a legitimate security interest and by the way, an exclusive security interest in our region? Russia wants to assert a similar sense. But I think the question that has to be asked is that in fact legitimate? Do we live in a world in which we say that regional powers have the right to a kind of hegemonic control over their neighborhood? Do we have that right over Mexico? Well, of course we don't. And you can't help but compare Russia's attitude towards its neighbors to China's attitude towards its neighbors. Yes, China's neighbors, like Japan and South Korea, are nervous about China's ambitions. And yet China goes to great lengths to have peaceable relationships with its neighbors because China's goal is to produce a generally peaceable international environment within which it can carry out its domestic projects of growth. Russia has turbulent relationships with its neighbors and almost seems to seek those turbulent relationships. So it's very hard to say to Georgia or to Ukraine or to Azerbaijan or any of the other neighbors, well, you know, Russia has a legitimate interest in what? In what? In keeping you subdued? In preventing you from joining the West? I'm not sure that qualifies as a legitimate interest.
Well, I guess the argument might be if you join NATO, then we could have, you know, American or British missiles, you know, pointed down our throats.
Yeah, I think here we come to what seems to me like a genuinely legitimate interest. And I do think that of all these things that Russia has said it opposes, the American anti-missile system is the one that is the hardest to justify from the Western point of view. It does strike me as a needless provocation. There is no question that it feels to Russia like it is arrayed against Russia. Now, the Bush administration has gone to great lengths to say, you can work with us on these installations. We want to make sure you know that they are not pointed at you but at Iran. Nevertheless, you know, Russia has clearly taken this ill. And I can understand why. So, yeah, I think in that case especially, you know, there's reason for Russia to be upset, though they've gone about it in their usual way, which is they appear to have cut off the supply of natural gas to the Czech Republic as punishment for the Czech Republic agreeing to accept those anti-missile systems based there.
We're speaking with James Traub. He is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and his new book is The Freedom Agenda. We'll talk more about the situation in Georgia after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is James Traub. He is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He has a new book called The Freedom Agenda. He's written widely about the situation in Georgia and Russia. So let's talk a little bit about the peculiar relationship between Russia and Georgia, which is, for folks who don't study the World Atlas so frequently, in the Caucasus, that band of mountainous land between, I guess, the Black and the Caspian Seas, right?
That's right.
Tell us what Georgians think about Russia, first of all.
Well, again, for me, as someone who grew up towards the end of the Cold War, it's really startling to go to a place like Georgia and hear people talk about Russia because they loathe the Russians. They fear the Russians. They have behind them generations of tortured relationships with Russia. And this is something I think you find throughout the region, this very complicated and largely painful relationship with Russia. So if you look at Georgian history, Georgia is a very, very ancient country. It goes back to the time of the Greek Empire and even before. From 1800 or so, Georgia was absorbed into Russia, into Tsarist Russia, and not happily, by the way. And so that lasts for over 100 years. And then when the Soviet Union forms, Georgia has a very brief interval. For 3 years, Georgia had something like a liberal, social democratic, cosmopolitan, from what I can tell, quite impressive republic.
Right after World War One, right?
Right after World War One, and in the chaos of the immediate post-revolutionary period. But then this came to a brutal end in 1921 when the Bolshevik government of the Soviet Union came in and subjugated the country, and the government had to flee. So from that time forward, Georgia was once again, as it had been before, incorporated into Russia, now the Soviet Union. But the Georgians never lost their sense that we are a separate people. The Georgian language is nothing like the Russian language. So they have a deep sense of Georgian Eastern Orthodox rites are different from Russian Eastern Orthodox rites and so on. So they have this sense of being a separate people. At the same time, they're deep, deep ties, as you can imagine, to Russia, of which it has been a part for two centuries.
So what do the Russians think about Georgia?
The Russians have, I guess, a kind of love-hate relationship with Georgia. For all of those long decades of Soviet rule, Georgia was Russia's Italy. It was a warm place, literally a warm place. It was a place where you would go to the beach, to the Black Sea. It was the place famous for its feasts, for its dancing, for its singing, for a sense of joyousness, also for gangsters. I mean, it really is a lot like Italy that way. And so as much as the Soviet Union felt like a dead, frozen place, there was always the reassurance that in the Russian soul and in the Soviet Union, there was this place that was very different. And if you were a member of the elite, you would have your dasha there. You would have your house by the seaside, and you would live a different life, and you would taste all those joys that were forbidden to the Soviet people. And so when Georgia declared its independence from Russia, that is to say, when the Soviet Union broke up, the same thing repeated itself as happened when the Tsarist Empire broke up. Georgia said once again, you know, we don't want to be part of this collective. We declare our independence. That was a terrible blow to the Soviet Union. Worse, I think, or so people tell me, than say when the Baltic states, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, when they broke away because they did not feel like they were part of Russia's soul, as Georgia and also Ukraine did. So these were terrible blows to the national psyche.
It's interesting that in some respects you describe sort of Russians looking at Georgia as with some affection. And yet in a recent piece, you made reference to people talking about a poll in which Georgia was viewed by Russians as their number one enemy.
Yes, because Georgia has chosen to repudiate Mother Russia. And so one of the things that is just striking about Russia in terms of psyche is this idea that Georgia is an evil enemy, almost because it's like an intransigent child or a prodigal child or something. How can Georgia be rejecting us? Now, let us add something into the mix, which is Georgia, too, has its aggressive, ambitious, eager, dynamic, and rather confrontational president in Mikhail Saakashvili. And so while other states along Russia's border, like Azerbaijan, for example, have sought a relatively independent course and have tried to ally themselves more with the West, they have also been suitably deferential, not necessarily out of respect, but out of a proper sense of fear. Now, that's not Georgia. Georgia is quite happy to stick its thumb in Russia's eye, and Saakashvili is quite happy to stick his thumb in Russia's eye. A person who knows Saakashvili well told me that he had made a very clever pun out of the name of Vladimir Putin, who you know is quite short, Saakashvili being quite tall, and he called him Lily Putin for Lilliputian, the little people in Swift. Now, Saakashvili denies ever having said that, and I don't know whether he did or not. But the point is that is the way he treats Putin. And Putin is a person for whom personal pride is a matter of great importance, and national pride too. And so another aspect of the Russian anger at Georgia is not simply Georgia's independence, but Georgia's rather reckless assertions of its independence.
And that brings us to the flashpoint of this current conflict, and that is these two, as they're described, breakaway regions, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, these two regions that are historically part of Georgia but which have asserted their independence. Explain their relationship with the Georgian nation.
Well, okay, this gets complicated, and I'll try to do it in short form. When Georgia declared its independence from Russia in 1991, it use the boundaries that had been created by the Soviet Union. And now those included other ethnicities besides Georgians, including the Ossetians in this province called South Ossetia and the Abkhaz in a province called Abkhazia. Well, those people tended to view Georgians the way Georgians viewed Russians, as this big neighboring bully. And they said, just as Georgia said, we don't want to be part of Russia, they said, we don't want to be part of Georgia. And so this then precipitated wars, civil wars in both areas, quite bloody, with very with well-substantiated claims of atrocities on both sides in each case. And so first in South Ossetia in 1991 and 2, and then in Abkhazia in 1992 through 1994, you had these brutal battles, which ultimately came to an end having been officiated by Russia and were resolved, or rather at least put in place, through the presence of Russian peacekeeping forces, though technically the peacekeeping forces came from something called the Commonwealth of Independent States, which is a thing that Boris Yeltsin created out of the post-Soviet world. But effectively, it meant Russian peacekeepers were standing in between the Georgians on one side and either the Ossetians or the Abkhaz on the other.
James Traub is a contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies. And this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, announcing Kids Count, a state-by-state look at child well-being and juvenile justice reform at aecf.org. And from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation about the fighting between Russia and Georgia with James Traub. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Real Animal, the new album from Alejandro Escovedo. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross, back with journalist James Traub. We're talking about the crisis in Georgia. Though a ceasefire has been negotiated, there have been continued reports of fighting and of Russian troop movements outside the breakaway regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia, where they were to be confined. James Traub is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Before the break, we were talking about the relationship the breakaway provinces have with Russia and Georgia. To clarify one thing, the Russians obviously play a role here because they're a powerful neighbor, but are the citizens of South Ossetia and Abkhazia ethnically Russian or culturally more tied to Russia?
they are culturally more tied to Russia. But if you ask what is they're most like, I mean, I can speak more easily about Abkhazia because I spent time there. I did not spend time in South Ossetia on this trip, so I'm not comfortable talking about how they feel. The Abkhaz are, if anything, frightened to death of the Russian embrace. That is, they fear that they will be incorporated into Russia and will become one of those defunct ethnic groups like the Ubiks, of which one hears very little today because they don't exist anymore. They were Russified. The Abkhaz don't want to be Georgianized. They don't want to be incorporated into Georgia, but they also don't want to be incorporated into Russia. They fear they are, in fact, an independent ethnic group. You have to bear in mind that the Caucasus, being laced by mountains and all sorts of geographical barriers, is the kind of region where you have myriad separate, relatively independent language groups and culture groups. And both the Ossetians and the Abkhaz count as that. Very small, by the way. The Abkhaz, maybe there are 100,000 people who are of Abkhazian background who are today in the region of Abkhazia. Most of the others were deported by the Tsars in the 19th century or by Stalin's Soviet Union later on. So it's a little country, but they feel like we are a separate people. We want to have our own state. And when I say to them, yeah, but how do you feel about having Russia as your so-called protector? They say, no, we have to choose between two evils. We're afraid of Russia, but we're also afraid of Georgia. And right now, Russia is going to protect us from Georgia. So we'll deal with that one now, and we'll worry later about the consequences.
So when Russia intervenes militarily, I mean, before the current crisis, when they have sent troops to these two regions that seek autonomy from Georgia, can you say with authority whether they're acting to protect citizens who look like them, feel like them, want them, or are they cynically intervening as a way of gaining an advantage against Georgia?
Well, two different questions. The Abkhaz and the Ossetians, as I said, are happy to have the protection of Russia because if they didn't, they would have been reabsorbed into Georgia in a minute. They could never defend themselves. At the same time, on Russia's part, it's a cynical act. That is, Russia is doing this in the name of preserving the well-being and also the autonomy of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Look at Russia's behavior in Chechnya. This is not a country which shows much sensitivity towards the desires, the aspirations for autonomy of ethnically distinct peoples. Nobody whom I met in Abkhazia believes that the Russians actually care about Abkhaz independence. They assume that the Russians are using them in their game against the West and in their game against Georgia. And as I say, they very much worry about the end game of that game. No one is more clear-minded about the cynicism of Russian motives than the Abkhaz are. They just feel like it's the best possibility in a very bad situation.
Your piece in this Sunday's New York Times bore the headline Taunting the Bear, suggesting that the government of Georgia and its president, Saakashvili, was provoking the Russian government and that is in part what led to this current crisis. What did the Georgians do that provoked the Russians?
Well, I think there has been, since Saakashvili became president in 2003, there's been a very, very different atmosphere between Georgia and Russia. And so Saakashvili very openly courts the West, very openly criticizes Russia, has spoken openly of his desire to regain these provinces which have been effectively autonomous since the early 90s. And so one of the provinces called Adjara, which is a province to the west, he was able to regain without any military conflict in 2004. He then made a quite open effort to do the same thing with South Ossetia. He sent Interior Ministry troops in during the summer of 2004 saying he wanted to quell banditry. This was understood to be, in fact, an attempt to subjugate the government of this de facto republic, and the troops were quite humiliatingly beaten back by Ossetian irregulars. There then followed a period of a year or two when he actually tried negotiated solutions, but I would say half-heartedly. And then in 2006, sent troops into an area which is in Abkhazia called the Kadori Gorge, again saying that he had to stop banditry, which by the way, was quite rampant. But this, again, was seen as Saakashvili saying, I am willing to use military force to change the situation on the ground. We then fast forward to 2008 when hostilities begin to rise again in March of 2008 because here we get rather complicated. But when the West recognized Kosovo, Russia was outraged. Russia is an ally of Serbia. And decided to take it out of the West's hide in the form of growing confrontation with Georgia, which it sees, not incorrectly, as the darling of the West. And so as Putin started to ratchet up the tension in Abkhazia, Saakashvili appeared to have made preparations for battle in Abkhazia. There were troop movements, there were fuel dumps being readied and so on. And so both the Abkhaz and the Russians saw this as a sign that Saakashvili was all too willing to use military force in order to satisfy the promises he had made to the Georgian people of regaining these territories. And indeed, that appears to be what happened in South Ossetia.
You and I have talked about Vladimir Putin, and others have. He is, of course, not the president of Russia anymore. It's actually Dmitry Medvedev. What's his role in this?
You know, that's been a mystery, as indeed the relationship between the two is something of a mystery. Medvedev appears to have had no meaningful role in this. It was Putin who left the Olympics in Beijing and flew to Vladikavkaz, a town just in North Ossetia, and basically quite publicly, openly, commanded the troops, which of course is the role of the president, not the prime minister. Only on about day three was Medvedev able to make a public statement in which he essentially echoed the same line that Putin had already taken. So far as one can tell from the outside, this has shown quite transparently what people already thought, which is the power lies with Putin and Medvedev is essentially a figurehead. I'm sure that they'll put Medvedev forward in future to allow him to play the role that he is supposed to play, but the fact is the shots are being called by Putin.
We're speaking with James Traub. He has written about the current crisis between Georgia and Russia in the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is James Traub. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called The Freedom Agenda. So President Bush issued a strong condemnation and warnings to the Russians about their behavior. Did that have any effect?
Well, the thing we don't know is exactly what Putin intended when he sent those troops across the borders from South Ossetia and into Georgia proper. And I should also say, from Abkhazia as well, troops came pouring in and have gone into Georgia proper. Did he intend to actually try to take the capital? And was he then given pause by the Western reaction? It's possible. I very much doubt it. I assume that Putin's goal all the time was to make the Georgians live in fear of what Russia could do if it wanted to, and thereby to gain compliance with Russian wishes. Probably also his hope was to humiliate Saakashvili, whom he obviously loathes, and ultimately lead to Saakashvili being deposed. He achieved all those goals. He perhaps also hoped to say to the West, don't let this country enter NATO. We will not permit it. This country is ours. It is not yours. He may have succeeded in that. We don't know. So my guess is that the statements by Bush and others had no effect at all on Russian calculations. I think that from the very beginning, Putin was going to do what he wanted to do and achieve what he wanted to achieve. And then the question would always be, and it will be as of now, how will the West react to this, what I would characterize as a naked act of aggression?
And to what extent is the West's leverage in this situation compromised by, A, Russia's enormous profits from oil and natural gas, and the United States' military extension, preoccupation in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, you know, it's very easy for the West to denounce military activities by rogue regimes and to punish them. This is Russia. This is not some small country. This is a huge, powerful, growing country with which both the United States and all major European countries have ongoing commercial, military, intelligence, and so forth relationships. And so what do you do? How do you balance the need to say this cannot stand, this is not how we behave in the 21st century, with the need to transact all the kind of business one transacts with Russia? So from the point of view of the United States, the big question is Iran. We are trying to keep the Security Council together on tightening the screws on Iran through sanctions. That means we need Russia and we need China. So Washington is afraid of losing Russia on that, and that may stay its hand when it comes to issues like, do we punish Russia by keeping it out of the G7? Do we try to keep it out of the World Trade Organization? And do we tell Georgia, yes, it can get into NATO? From the point of view of Europe, the considerations have less to do with Iran and more to do with very important commercial relationships. Germany gets 40% of its natural gas from Russia. Germany has seen what Russia has done to refractory countries. It tells them you can freeze in the dark. Now, Russia cares a lot about its dependability as a supplier to major countries. That is, it's willing to jerk around the little countries, but it knows that economically it depends on the big countries like Germany, France, Italy, and so forth, feeling that they can rely on Russia. Russia would be unhappy to have to use that weapon, but Germany could well think, well, if we get Russia angry enough, we no longer trust what they'll do. Maybe they will use that weapon. So yes, everybody has something to worry about when it comes to taking measures against Russia.
As we speak, events are fluid in Georgia, and there are conflicting reports about what's actually happening on the ground. But we do know that a ceasefire of sorts was negotiated with the French leader Nicolas Sarkozy. What are its terms, and what do they tell us about how this has played out?
Well, the ceasefire says that both sides will withdraw to the status quo ante as of Thursday, meaning that there would be Russian peacekeepers, Russian troops, on the South Ossetian side of that border and on the Abkhaz side of the Abkhaz border. There are no Georgian troops that are now in Abkhaz or Ossetian territory. They're gone. So that's not really the issue. The issue really is, will the Russians withdraw to that line? So far, they haven't. So far, there's no signs of withdrawal at all. And indeed, there are continuing reports of ongoing hostilities. But then the question is, okay, let's say the Russians agree. And they do indeed stop fighting. They don't seek to take Tbilisi. And gradually, the troops withdraw from Gori and Poti and these other cities in Georgia proper.
Tbilisi is the capital of Georgia. You're saying that you're talking about the Russians withdrawing from areas of Georgia beyond these two breakaway provinces, right?
Well, in other words, right now you have Russian troops inside Georgia proper. They have not sought, so far as we know, to march on Tbilisi, but they are present in a series of cities that are within 20 or 30 miles of the borders of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. So the ceasefire requires them to leave and to go back to the other side of those ceasefire lines.
To stay in the breakaway republics.
Right, exactly, because that's where they were previously as peacekeepers, and they formally are claiming that all of these military operations are in their role as peacekeepers, though God knows this is not a form of peacekeeping anybody has witnessed before. And so then the question is, okay, now what? Saakashvili will not acknowledge the rights of independence of either of these breakaway republics. He has always campaigned that he's the guy who's going to get them back. Well, that's finished. That's finished. You can talk about it all you want. At this point, those two breakaway areas are neither going to come under Georgian control, nor are they going to be truly autonomous. They have been effectively absorbed into Russia, whatever their formal status is. And so then the question ongoing is, will there be some way of creating a formal status for these two places, which Russia can live with, Georgia can live with, and the breakaway republics themselves can live with? That's going to be a long-term question. We can't worry about that too much right now. Right now, the big concern is get those Russian troops out of Georgia and then at least begin negotiating in a more in a less threatening environment.
So just to be clear, apart from the question of whether Russian troops stay in or advance in Georgia itself. The ceasefire essentially says the Russians get to stay in these two breakaway provinces and the Georgian troops have to get out. I mean, is that a humiliating defeat for Georgia?
Oh, utterly, utterly. I mean, for Saakashvili, it's a calamity. It's a catastrophe. Though the actual origins of this war are still a little bit murky, it is clear that Saakashvili decided last Thursday night that he would no longer accept what had become a simmering low-level war in South Ossetia and that he would attack the capital, shelling, sending in troops and so forth, which in retrospect was a really stupid thing to have done, and which, at least according to my information, Washington had been telling him regularly, don't do it. He sent the troops in, and now the troops have been were crushed and were humiliatingly forced to return to Tbilisi. So now, in terms of domestic politics, Saakashvili at this very moment seems to be enjoying a wave of nationalist support, but it won't last long. And the sense of humiliation that Georgian people will have will make them turn on him. So I think he's now in a very, very dangerous place politically.
I'd like to get your take on what the presidential candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, have said about this crisis.
You know, I think the statements have been pretty similar. And I was very struck when I, in the course of reporting this article that I wrote, that the chief advisors to McCain and Obama had surprisingly similar views of Russia and of Georgia. Now, Georgia is the one country or one of the few countries that would vote McCain if they had a choice to vote. It's McCain territory. McCain has been there. He and Saakashvili have a real love fest. McCain is a deep believer in democracy promotion. Georgia is a great example of American democracy promotion. And so he's come out quite strenuously in support of Georgia and a criticism of Russia. McCain takes a more anti-Russian view than Obama does. And he has for quite a while, maybe in part because one of his chief advisors, Robert Kagan, a well-known foreign policy theorist, takes similar views himself. Obama, of course, naturally has a more accommodating view of intransigent countries. But the statement that he put out in the aftermath quite unambiguously blamed Russia for violating Georgia's territorial integrity. I suspect Saakashvili himself feared that if Obama won, he would no longer have the kind of support he had before, which may in part explain why he was willing to do this thing now. Whether or not that's selling Obama short, I don't know. What I can say is that I know the people who give him advice on this issue, and they seem to have a strongly pro-Georgian point of view.
You know, one criticism of McCain that I've heard, I guess, from liberal Democrats is that if we had adopted his view that Georgia should have joined NATO, that the United States might have been compelled to respond militarily to the Russian incursion. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, yeah. And I think that Russia knows this very well. And so it's been in Russia's interest to keep Georgia embroiled in battle because that prevents that makes the argument that Georgia should not be permitted to join NATO. So that's a real concern. Technically, yes. I mean, if Georgia had been a member of NATO, you could have imagined a kind of 1914 scenario in which a series of events in a remote place trip a series of automatic alliances which lead to war. And so that's a very serious concern. At the same time, can we permit Russia to dictate the question of who gets to join NATO? And I think the answer to that has to be no, we can't. To be pragmatic, by the way, what in fact would happen is not Georgia and Ukraine would become members of NATO. They would be put on a track to join NATO over time, and there were a series of stages in that track before they became full-fledged members of NATO. And so that's what's being contemplated now. The next meeting of the NATO ministers will be in December when they'll decide if anybody new should be put on that track, and anybody new means Georgia and Ukraine. And it is a really grave question as to whether or not these hostilities will prevent Georgia from being able to join NATO, or the opposite, will persuade NATO members that Georgia has a right to the protective umbrella of NATO.
Well, James Trout, thanks so much for sharing your views with us.
Thank you.
James Traub is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of the forthcoming book, The Freedom Agenda. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Real Animal, the new album from Alejandro Escovedo. This is Fresh Air. Alejandro Escovedo has been performing for more than three decades in a variety of styles, punk rock in the 70s, country and glam rock in the 80s, and as a singer-songwriter in recent years. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Escovedo's new album, Real Animal, is the artist's summing up of his own career thus far.
That's Alejandro Escovedo professing his allegiance to someone he's fond of, including his audience, in a song that deserves to be one of the big hits of the summer. Escovedo is one of the phantom presences in modern rock music, moving through the walls of various genres, inhabiting them with spooky intensity, and then drifting on. In the 70s, going with the angry lark that was punk rock, he did the San Francisco version of it in a band called The Nuns. They never achieved even punk rock size success, but they did end up opening for the Sex Pistols in 1978, a ghost footnote in history. He summons up this era in a very clever self-parody, a song that works better than any that the Nuns themselves ever recorded.
We don't want your approval. It's 1978. We know we're not in tune. We know we'll never be great. We made it this far. A little piece of fame up on the bandstand. Nobody knows no shame. Louis, Louis, Tommy.
We know we're not in tune. We know we'll never be great, he sings there, with a perfect mock sneer. Pretty soon, the 80s rolled around and Escovedo started making countrified rock and roll in the band Rank and File, with the brother team of Chip and Tony Kinman. So he wrote a song about them here called, sensibly enough, Chip and Tony.
All I ever wanted was a four-piece band. Strong just like an accident.
The sound of this album is remarkably eclectic, as befits a career as peripatetic and questing as Escovedo's, who's moved from San Francisco to L.A. to Manhattan to Austin, Texas, and I may not even have that map entirely accurate given the way he's jumped around. It was produced by Tony Visconti, who produced some of the best albums by David Bowie and T-Rex. Escovedo has impeccable taste in collaborators. Nobody left unbroken. Nobody left unscarred. Nobody here is talking. That's just the way things are. There's a strain of elegiac emotion coursing through this album as Escovedo sings about friends who've died and his own fragile health. A few years ago, he almost died from complications of hepatitis C. He's reportedly in good health these days, though, and has come through 3 decades of music making with a bracing distrust of misty-eyed nostalgia or weepy gratitude. One song here bears the title Sensitive Boys. He is one himself, but he's the kind that hard-boils his sensitivity to achieve both terse poetry and some generously open-hearted rock and roll.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Real Animal by Alejandro Escovedo.
Sensitive boys. Sensitive clothes.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, John Sheehan, and Jonathan Menjivar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Big dreamy eyes, long French sleeves, shivering in the cold light of the New York City heat. Sensitive boy.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, whose 4-day poetry festival starts September 25th in Waterloo Village, New Jersey, at dodgepoetryfestival.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer Glenn Campbell on his 50 years in the music business. He's got a new album. Join us.